ghosts, have they become a cliche? Or can we once again examine this phenomena seriously? After all, isn't it really our own afterlife we're curious about? Let's delve a little deeper on Jim Harold's Ghost Insight. Today on the program, I think we're going to have a fascinating discussion. We're going to take a look at the paranormal through the academic lens. And our guest is Dr. Jack Hunter, and he is the author of the recent book, Engaging the Anomalous, Collected Essays on Anthropology, the Paranormal, Mediumship, and Extraordinary Experiences. He is an anthropologist exploring the borderlines of consciousness, religion, and the paranormal living in the hills of Mid Wales. His doctoral research with the University of Bristol examined the experiences of spirit mediums and their influence on the development of self-concepts and models of consciousness, and is an effort towards a non-reductive anthropology of the paranormal. He's founder and editor of Para-Anthropology, Journal of Anthropological Approaches to the Paranormal. He's the author of Why People Believe in Spirits, Gods, and Magic, editor of Strange Dimensions, Para-Anthropological Anthology, or close to that, Damned Facts, easier for me to say, Fortean Essays on Religion, Folklore, and the Paranormal, and co-editor with Dr. David Luke of Talking with the Spirits, Ethnographies from Between the Worlds. Now, there's a whole host of other credits here, but needless to say, he is very engrossed. All this work has done many, many things, and we are glad to have him with it, despite the fact that I had difficulty getting through that bio. Dr. Hunter, welcome to the program today.
Thanks for having me.
I was doing pretty good until I hit para-anthropology, and that one tripped me up.
That's a tricky word.
So I want to understand where you're coming from. It says here that you've kind of spearheaded an effort towards a non-reductive anthropology of the paranormal. Now, to me, anthropology, when I think of it, it's studies of a culture. For example, you might look into a third world culture or an ancient culture and understand how they lived and how they did things, if I'm thinking around the right area. So can you talk to anthropology as you see it in relation to the paranormal? And also, what is a non-reductive anthropology of the paranormal?
Okay, cool. So I'll just explain what anthropology is in general first. It's a way, well, actually, in the American Academy, it's split into four different groups. So you've got archaeology, which is the study of ancient civilizations or past cultures. You've got linguistic anthropology, which is the study of languages. You've got cultural anthropology, which is the study of human cultures and societies. And then you also have biological anthropology, which is kind of like human evolution and all those kinds of things. So the kind of anthropology that I'm interested in is social or cultural anthropology. So interested in different societies, different cultures, and how they kind of live their lives. But it is a bit of a misconception that in order to do anthropology, you have to go to far off distant countries, or third world countries, or out to the rainforest. You can actually do anthropology wherever there are human beings. So obviously, as a study of human beings, that's all you really need. And I could probably even argue that you could do a kind of anthropology even on your own, just using your own kind of experience of the world as data. So I came across this group called the Bristol Spirit Lodge, where they interact with spirits on a regular basis. It was a group in Bristol, so it's not in the Amazon or anywhere like that. And I just went there and I did a bit of ethnography, which is one of the main research methods in anthropology. And it involves participating in the kind of the society or the culture that you're studying, writing notes about that, and then formulating your ideas after the fact. And as soon as I started to participate in this kind of paranormal subculture in Bristol, I started to have kind of experiences that seem to accord well with their beliefs. And that's really where this idea of paranthropology comes from, is an anthropological approach to understanding these kinds of paranormal beliefs, paranormal experiences from an experiential perspective.
Now, when we talk about people who study the paranormal, they divide relatively evenly in two camps. I guess there's kind of the middle ground, but on one side, you have kind of the true believers. They say, yeah, there's something to this stuff, and it's real, and don't tell me otherwise. And then you've got the other side, which kind of seems at least the most vocal part of it, skews towards debunkers, who say, hey, I don't want to hear of any of this because none of it exists. Yeah. And I'm kind of consider myself a skeptical believer. I might be skeptical of any one case, but I believe there is something going on. Do you see yourself as an anthropologist kind of at arm's length? And in other words, it's just kind of like, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but you study this like you would study a colony of ants, or do you feel, as you say, you've had this experience. Did you start out that way? And have you kind of become more of a participant in it and maybe more of a believer? Where are you personally?
That's a good question. The way I tend to think about it is that, you know, when you start to believe in something, this is just for me from my personal standpoint. When you start to believe in something, then you kind of fix yourself down to a particular position.
Sure.
So I don't really think of myself as a believer necessarily. And I generally describe myself kind of like as an entertainer of possibilities. So I'm open to the possibility of all of these different things and the kinds of experiences that I've had throughout my life, ranging from, you know, psychedelic experiences to weird dreams and my experiences doing field work with mediums. All of those experiences that I've had seem to point towards the world being kind of more complicated and more interesting than the standard, you know, reductive materialist worldview seems to allow for. So my perspective really is kind of like an exploratory, open-minded kind of approach. Yeah. Not believing anything necessarily, but entertaining possibilities and exploring things in kind of like at face value.
I love that approach. I think that's a fantastic approach. Not nailing yourself, as you said, down to one perspective, being willing to be fluid depending on the circumstances, but saying, yes. Hey, maybe there's something here. It seems like there may be, but, you know, I'm not going to, you know, leave the university and, you know, walk around with crystals or something. Okay. So when we talk about this book, Engaging the Anomalous, now, as I understand, this is a series of writings you had over a number of years. So what is the scope of the book? What is the idea of the book?
Yeah, the book is a collection of essays that I've written over the last probably about seven or 8 years since I started researching for my doctorate. So I started in 2010, and all of these essays were kind of written alongside my research. So in a way, they're kind of like a proto version of my thesis. It's got a lot of the ideas that underpin the research that I did for my doctorate, and it kind of explores them in a more accessible kind of way than the thesis actually does. A lot of the essays were written for magazines and journals, so they should be, you know, reasonably accessible. But yeah, that's what it is. It's a collection of my kind of ideas, ranging from very early ideas to more developed ones as I was coming towards the end of my thesis. So it's really like a development of my thinking about the paranormal and mediumship in particular.
If you see that show, X-Files, the famous show that was on in the 90s and has recently been revived, there's this saying, I want to believe. Now, the question is, and I would think that you would have a great perch to kind of pontificate on this, is why do we want to believe? Because I do believe many of us want to believe.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of different reasons. Again, we're not going to be able to pinpoint it and say that we have the explanation for why all of these different people believe these things. There's lots of different factors. So one of them, you know, is a classic psychological one, a psychological functional explanation, is that, you know, it gives us kind of like a hope that there might be something after death. The idea that there might be spirits is psychologically comforting to us and things like that. I mean, I think in some cases that might be the case. You know, I don't doubt that kind of process does take place in the world. But then there are also other cases. So you know, some people start to believe in the paranormal or believe in UFOs or whatever through direct experience. And those are the particularly interesting cases as far as I'm concerned, because those are the cases that seem to point towards the thing itself, if you know what I mean.
Now, in the book, you talk about supernatural or natural. And I'm guessing that might get to something that I've always been curious about. These things that we experience or other people experience, of course, there's some things that are hoaxes. Of course, there are people who sometimes misinterpret things or maybe see what they want to see. I think that even the most hardcore believer would admit that. And I think that is true. However, there's this kind of third category of things that seem to be reported by people of sound mind, credible people. So let's assume that they are observing something that is strange. Now, does that necessarily need to be something that is supernatural, something that has kind of this cosmic X factor involved, God, ghosts, aliens, whatever it might be? Or could there be natural scientific explanations, but our science just isn't there yet? For example, the example I always use is DNA. Now, DNA has always existed. But perhaps a couple of hundred years ago, if you would have told a scientist about DNA, they would have, oh, that's ridiculous. Where do you come down on that question?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. And it comes down to the way that our particular culture, our Western materialist culture thinks about the world. And actually the idea that the supernatural, you know, the idea of the supernatural as a category is pretty much a recent idea in the history of human thought. So, you know, up until, let's say, around about the Enlightenment in the like 17th century, 18th century, that's when people started to make a distinction between natural phenomena and supernatural phenomena. So it's really the idea of the supernatural is a kind of almost a product of science itself. The science is trying to demarcate a particular area of the world that they could investigate, and the supernatural was kind of pushed out on the other side. And if you look at other cultures around the world, cultures that haven't emerged from this same kind of Western philosophical tradition, then they don't necessarily make these distinctions at all. They don't make any distinction between what we would consider like paranormal or supernatural or miraculous events from the other kinds of natural phenomena that exist in the world around them, you know, the trees and the animals and the wind and all those kinds of things. So, yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think it's a question that really emerges from our like culture as a whole.
The other thing that's difficult when you talk about, and we'll use the word supernatural or paranormal, when you're talking about these anomalous phenomena, mm-hmm. one of the difficulties that I think that we have when talking to, say, traditional scientists, they'll say, well, you know, this, we can't measure this. We could have the most credible person in the world, the most intelligent person in the world, the most level-headed person in the world give us a personal experience, and yet that's really not evidence per se, because it's not something we can measure, with the standard deviation of the mean or in a laboratory or measure in a test tube or weigh on a scale.
Yep.
And because these things tend to happen, if they happen at all, in the real world, and they don't tend to be very friendly in laboratory conditions, or people aren't, at Carnegie Mellon aren't seeing UFOs pop out of the sky or seeing ghosts in laboratories. So I guess my point is this, is that how do you reconcile that? I think that some scientists just discount the whole thing because it's not really conducive to laboratory conditions. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, again, we've got some important issues coming up here about what science is and the kind of the limits of science, really. And also the kind of limits of our understanding as parts of the universe. I mean, should we really suppose that everything in the universe is going to be comprehensible to human beings? I mean, we're a part of the universe ourselves and we've emerged from within it. So perhaps there are aspects of the universe that we can't observe you know, objectively in the sense of observing like a laboratory conditions, and maybe elements of the paranormal. And I say elements because there are other elements of the paranormal that you can replicate in the lab, you know, like small psi effects and sure. those kinds of things. But maybe the kind of the weirder kind of high strangeness things are real, but not in the sense that objective science can measure. Do you see what I mean? That perhaps they are a different order of being in the universe, if that makes sense.
Actually, I agree with that observation. However, I know how the skeptic, and then when I talk about skeptics, I'm not talking about people who say, look, I'm skeptical of this one claim. I'm talking about the hardcore debunkers. But the hardcore debunker is going to say something to this effect. If you say it can't be measured by science, that's the ultimate cop-out. That's just an easy exit for the believer to use when they've been cornered by facts. Is that correct? Is that what they would say?
That's what they would say. But we've also got to bear in mind the fact that, you know, science is something that constantly develops and changes. And that, you know, the science of one era is totally different to the science of another, you know, 100 years later. So we don't know yet whether, you know, this subjective aspect of the universe, which is our experience of the world and all of the crazy things that happen within our experience, we don't know whether that is simply, you know, we can't explain it in terms of our current science, or whether perhaps, you know, 100 years down the line, science will have developed to the level where it can take that into account, you know, as a fundamental aspect of reality. I don't know. I mean, these are open questions. And like I said, we're dealing with the very limits of science.
And here's a question, and I deal with this all the time. I have a program called Campfire that people call in and share their personal experiences. And I am very supportive, and I believe that the vast majority of people that call into that program believe they have experienced something strange, something yeah. perhaps supernatural. I think for the vast majority, they're sincere. I think occasionally I've had a person or two call or maybe pull my leg, or maybe read a story that they found in a book somewhere. In that case, I obviously won't use it on the program. But overall, the vast majority of people, I think, are very sincere. Mm-hmm. How should we look at personal experiences and personal reports, in your view?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we do have to be careful when we're dealing with personal reports, because you're right, people can make stuff up, or people can embellish things, even if there is like a kernel of truth in there. So we've got to be wary of that. But, you know, there are ways that we can go about testing people's experiences, and we can participate. Like, for example, if an anomalous experience or something arises in a ritual situation, then we can replicate that. And we can go and see if we have those kinds of experiences ourselves. So that's one angle. We can take it seriously enough to go and test the claim, which is good. Another angle is that we should be taking these experiences seriously because, like you say, they're important parts of people's lives. And if we really want to understand the human condition, you know, as anthropologists or as psychologists or social scientists, or, you know, just as anyone really, then we should be taking into account those important aspects of their lives as well, not as aberrations or as something that needs to be cured or things like that, or something that people should be ashamed of, but as meaningful experiences that will be with people, you know, until the end of their life. It's a big part of life. And I don't think we should be ignoring that.
Do you think there's a trickster element in the paranormal? Let me explain. It seems though, when the times when people investigate these things, strange, bizarre things happen to them, or one area leads them into another area. Do you think that there could be something at play that's kind of having a colossal joke at our expense?
Yeah, it's entirely possible. And one of the things I've been thinking about recently is the idea that the universe itself, or like all of creation or all that exists, is some kind of a great big cosmic mind, and that we're trying to make sense of that mind in our lives and experience. And, you know, dealing with something as radically different, kind of intelligence or a kind of consciousness as radically different to our human consciousness as that would be, I just don't know whether we'd ever really be able to understand it. So, you know, it might seem like trickster activity to us. It might seem inconvenient that these, you know, that things aren't going our way, or that there's interferences, or you're getting led down different kinds of paths. But perhaps in the grand scheme of things, and obviously this is just pure speculation, but it's fun to speculate, but perhaps there is a meaning behind it, and that we just don't understand. We can't comprehend that other way of thinking. You can tie this in with, you know, thinking about the way that animals think. And there's a really interesting book at the moment about octopuses that I'm reading, about octopus consciousness, and just trying to imagine what it would be like to be an octopus. We could never understand that. Or there's interesting stuff about mycelial consciousness, and how their consciousness might be functioning along like really vast timescales. I think part of what we're trying to do is, with all of this research in the paranormal, is edging towards trying to be able to approach those questions of what that other mind is like. And yeah, I don't think we're there yet, but perhaps these trickster phenomena are kind of hints at what that mind is like.
It is fascinating to think of that. Now, in the book, you talk about the persistence of spirits, and that's really interesting to me. What do you mean by the persistence of spirit?
Yeah, in that chapter, what I'm writing about is how spirits, even in like a highly reductionist, mainstream, materialist academic setting, people are continuously drawn to the idea of spirits. So we have accounts of, you know, you can have researchers who investigate spirits from like in literature, and people who investigate spirits from parapsychology, and in anthropology, we've been interested in spirits for a really long time. So even in a highly materialist overall academic setting, spirits continue to kind of fascinate us, and academics as well. So the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, if we're researching spirits from a kind of like a ghost hunting perspective, or from a parapsychological perspective, there's also a whole load of other research and literature available in different disciplines as well that can be illuminating. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is that there's a whole load of different kind of academic work out there on spirits from all sorts of different perspectives. And we just need to start sharing ideas across disciplines so we can, you know, build up a more comprehensive understanding of what's going on.
When you talk about mediums, it's a fascinating topic to me, because I think there is, unfortunately, the possibility of fraud. You know, anywhere where there can be money involved, people can say, hey, I have a gift and you pay me $1,000 and I'll let you know how Aunt Millie is doing. And that kind of thing is unfortunate. However, just in my basic experience and an experience of others, I do believe that there's people who have some kind of a gift. I'll give you an example. We had a medium on our show. This is 10 years ago, probably, Carol Obley. And I had my wife call in, but I did not tell Carol that it was my wife, because we kind of wanted to test her, and a little devious, but anyway. And my wife was looking for a sign really from her mom. Well, no sign came, but Carol said something to the effect, well, you know, I'm picking up a Robert or a Bob, and a very young person who died unexpectedly. And he says hello. Well, Carol would have literally had no way to know this, because first of all, my wife is not a big social media person. This was quite a few years ago, even before, you know, social media fully hit. But there's no way that she could have gained that knowledge extraneously. She certainly didn't get it from me. Bob was my wife's best friend in high school, and he committed suicide. So, yeah. I mean, again, it could have been just a stroke of luck. You know, but yep. Boy, that seemed like, and I know what the skeptics say. They say, oh, you remember the hits, you forget the misses. I know cold reading had nothing to do with it, because there was nothing she could have asked her that could have, You know, it was not cold reading. So anyway, but something I presented to my wife just as a possibility, because I tend to believe that there are spirits, that there are communications from the dead. But I also open myself up to the opposite view that maybe some of these things are explicable in different ways. And here's something I put forth, because my wife likes to watch the TV psychics, and she was watching one. I won't say who it is. And said, this guy has really got a gift. Now, first of all, we don't know how those shows are shot, what kind of pre-interviews are done. But let's assume that this psychic read this person and had no pre-information and really was coming through with some really startling information that they couldn't have known. Now, I laid out an alternate possibility that's still fascinating, but not communicating with the dead. Okay, let's say that Dr. Hunter, you had an Uncle Bill. And I'm a medium, and you want to communicate with Uncle Bill. Okay, so you come to see me, and I believe I'm a medium. I'm 100% sincere, and I proceed to tell you all these things about Uncle Bill that only you would know. Mm-hmm. Well, aside from any possible fraud, there's two explanations, one for that. One, I'm communicating with Uncle Bill. Yep. Number two, there's telepathy going on. I'm reading your mind and I don't even realize it. What do you think about that possibility?
Yeah, that's a big, big question in parapsychology. It's called the survival versus psi debate. And you're right. When it comes to mental mediumship, so when you're talking about, you know, like clairvoyance or clairsentient mediumship, and even trance mediumship, when the spirits are trying to prove who they are, when you think about all of those kinds of things, those different kinds of mediumship, you can equally explain them in terms of the psi hypothesis, which is that, you know, perhaps the medium is doing some kind of a remote viewing and is able to go and, you know, flick through death records and things like that, or they're able to remote view into your house and see your, I don't know, photos and things like that. Or there's the telepathic hypothesis, which is also part of the psi hypothesis, which would be that the medium is literally reading your mind. And literally there's very little way that you would be able to 100% prove either way, whether the information came from a spirit or from psi. It's interesting though, that both of these explanations hint at a kind of a real paranormal aspect, which is positive, but yeah, distinguishing between spirits and psi is particularly difficult. I do know that people are doing it though. I know Julie Beischel and the Winbridge Institute are doing developing sort of experimental protocols for trying to distinguish between psi and mediumship. And they've also done interesting phenomenological studies of psi and of the differences in the experience of mediums when they're doing psi readings and when they're doing mediumistic readings. So mediums report that there are, you know, phenomenological differences between these two different processes. But yeah, it's still very difficult to distinguish between them.
And I could see a scenario where a psychic could completely believe they're touching the other side when they're just essentially, unbeknownst to them, mind reading. So in essence, they're not doing anything fraudulent. They believe as much as the person who's getting the reading, but they just don't realize. I wonder that sometimes. Still, even if that is the case, in some ways, as disappointing as that might be, it also speaks to the possibility of telepathy, which is amazing in and of itself. So I've always kind of wondered about that, because I don't believe 100% of purported psychics and mediums are frauds. I believe some of them are well-meaning and some of them believe they have a gift and they seem to be able to pull things out that do not make sense out of common means or explicable means.
Yeah.
Seances. They're not as much in fashion as they used to be. In terms of, if you think of the spiritualist era and those types of things, and you have a chapter here called Rethinking the Seance. What is Rethinking the Seance?
So what I'm trying to do in that chapter is kind of get people to think outside the box about seances. Because, you know, we have all of these preconceived ideas about what seances are, what it's like to go and see a medium. All of these things are influenced by the things that we see in the media, in films and the things that we read about in books. So, you know, when we think about a seance, we think of a gloomy Victorian manor house with, you know, flickering candles in the wind and things like that, and tables levitating and stuff. But, you know, as it happens today, most seances are not like that. And that actually, the seances that I've been to have all been really suburban, which is really interesting. So there's that side of things that we want to rethink the seance. It's not like that anymore. It's developed and changed over the years, even though it does share kind of common features. And then the other side of it is to think about the possibility that the kind of old explanatory frameworks that have been put forward for explaining mediumship and the way that seances function. So, you know, thinking in terms of fraud and performance and delusion, and thinking about from a more academic perspective, the social functional, social protest explanations and the cognitive explanations, and suggesting that perhaps the seance is something, or, you know, mediumship within the seance is something more than all of those things combined. So that those, all of those different explanations play a part, that sometimes there is fraud and sometimes there is a kind of a performative element, and sometimes mediumship is used for social protests and all those kinds of things, but that maybe there's also something else as well. And then from a kind of anthropological perspective, if you start to bring in the data from parapsychology, which seems to suggest that sometimes you can prove who these spirits are, and sometimes certain people are able to produce like miraculous psi events and all those kinds of things. When you start to take those into consideration, then the seance really does need reconsidering. It does need a new way of thinking about it. And what I would propose we do to start going about building a new idea of what the seance is to do a kind of experiential participatory anthropology and start from scratch, basically.
Now, the hardcore skeptic will say something like this, I think. The whole idea of the supernatural and the paranormal, it's just a fairy tale we tell ourselves as a self-defense mechanism against our fear of mortality.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
I would say there is that angle involved, that, you know, that these phenomena do perform, or these beliefs do perform psychological functions in some cases, but certainly not in all cases. And I would point towards the kind of experiential dimension as well, which is much more difficult to explain away in those kind of really clear-cut terms. So the fact that people seem to have these experiences all over the world in different cultures, even if cultures influence the way the experience comes across, there are certain kinds of key features that emerge. And the simple fact that that happens at all, that there are these similarities, demands that we investigate it further. So that's what I would say to skeptics who threw that argument at me, is that there clearly is a phenomenon here, whether we want to call it paranormal or supernatural or whatever, or whether we want to call it perfectly natural, something is going on and it needs investigating.
On these programs, we love stories. Do you have a story or two? I mean, I know that you come at this as an anthropologist, I think trying to take a very level-headed view of all of it. But also, you said you've had experiences, you've been involved with these groups now and seen things. What are a couple of things that have happened to you that kind of made you say, well, let's put this anthropology stuff aside for a minute. Wow, this is something else. There's something really strange going on.
Yeah. In the very first seance that I attended at the Bristol Spirit Lodge, I saw what was later described to me as a transfiguration. So it's believed in spiritualism that sometimes spirits can present their faces over the top of the medium's face, kind of like an ectoplasmic mask. And during the very first seance that I attended, I saw something that, you know, as far as I'm concerned and as far as my experience is concerned, matched up with that idea of a materializing face that slowly disappears. As I saw the medium's face beginning to kind of like shift and transform, and a kind of monk's face in green kind of appeared over her face and then kind of slowly slid down her chest and then disappeared. And it was such an unusual experience. I couldn't tell whether it was an objective experience out there in the world, or whether it was me kind of hallucinating in the red light or something. But either way, I had the experience. And then later, when we went out into the house again to have tea and cake at the end of the seance, I kind of kept this to myself. I didn't want to talk about it because, you know, it's a strange experience. And then one of the other participants in the seance said, "Oh, did you see that green face? Did you see that monk's face over the medium's face?" And I was just like, okay, yeah, that's interesting. I had what seemed to be a subjective hallucination that someone else seemed to have picked up on in some way. So there seemed to be like an intersubjective element going on there, that, you know, maybe we were all hallucinating the same thing, or maybe there was something genuinely there. I don't know, but it was an interesting experience nonetheless. And the fact that it had that extra little bit of validation was really interesting.
Do you feel, in all the work you're doing, do you feel that maybe the, as we would say in America, the ball is advancing? In other words, I've always had this feeling, and I've only been involved in all of this for about 13 years. I've been interested my whole life, but only been doing the shows about 13 years. But it seems like to me, sometimes we're like hamsters on a wheel. And I don't know if we're going to get closer to a better way of looking at all of this, or an explanation or that. What is your view?
I think that we can move towards a better way of engaging with these things, but it's going to be an approach that is probably radically different to the approach that we've, you know, traditionally applied to it. We're going to have to kind of step outside of our constant desire to kind of experimentally verify things and move towards a much more kind of experiential, and I think probably a holistic perspective. I don't want to sound too like wishy-washy saying that, but ultimately we're going to have to realize that, and I think this is what comes across in engaging the anomalous, is that all of these different explanations that we come up with are only parts of the picture, and that the picture itself is something that is really, really complex. So we're going to have to learn kind of a new science. I mean, I know there is complexity theory and science and all these kinds of things. We need to kind of keep building on that and expand it out into the social sciences and think about the role of experience and, change the way that we think about what science is and how you go about doing science. One really good example that I like to think about is there's a psychologist or parapsychologist called Charles Tart, and he has this idea of a first person science. So in state specific science, you could have all sorts of different scientific approaches that are suited to particular states of consciousness. So you could have like LSD science, for example, or psilocybin science. And obviously the kind of rules and things that apply in those different states of consciousness are completely different. It just goes to show you could have, you know, you can take the idea of science and expand it out in any direction that you want to go. And I think that's what needs to happen. We need to, you know, push beyond the boundaries of what is acceptable and, you know, what is acceptable and mainstream science at the moment, and think about new possibilities. Because probably the way the universe or the multiverse or all that exists works is way weirder and way more complex than any kind of model we've come up with has been able to account for. So, yeah, we need to keep science moving forwards.
Well, Dr. Jack Hunter is doing his part. His book is Engaging the Anomalous, Collected Essays on Anthropology, the Paranormal, Mediumship, and Extraordinary Experience. And we're so glad we've had him with us today. Dr. Hunter, where can people find the book and more information on everything you do?
Yeah, you can find out about me and my work and all the different kinds of things I do on my website, which is jack-hunter.webstarts.com. And you can get hold of Engaging the Anomalous and all of my other edited and authored books on Amazon, amazon.com and .co.uk. And you can probably even get hold of most of them in bookshops as well. So if you go into bookshops and ask them to order them in, they'll be able to track them down and order them. So yeah, they should be pretty easy to get hold of.
Well, we've been glad to have him on the show. An interesting perspective. I think it kind of does us well to step back and look at things from a different point of view, I think we've been able to do that today, and Dr. Hunter has been very helpful. The book is Engaging the Anomalous, Collected Essays on Anthropology, the Paranormal, Mediumship, and Extraordinary Experience. Dr. Hunter, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this program as much as I did. I thought Dr. Hunter provided a very interesting perspective on paranormal phenomena. And we'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, and thanks for your support as a Plus member. Bye-bye, everybody.